baby. I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Hello, welcome to Space Boffins in partnership with the Naked Scientists and supported by the UK Space Agency. I'm Sue Nelson.
And I'm Richard Hollingham. This time, a year away from its destination, we catch up with, although not literally, Europe's mission to Mercury. Plus, we'll discuss Boeing's Starliner spacecraft, finally due for blast off in the coming weeks. And as promised, my conversation with NASA legend George Abbey, which includes an insight into the decision to accelerate the Apollo program.
He said if we maintained the present sequence of missions, we probably weren't going to land by the end of the decade. And he had a new approach and was going to propose to the NASA leadership, if Apollo 7 was successful, that we would go to the moon on the next flight.
Great gravelly voice there. He sounds like he should be on some sort of Western, doesn't he? It's very Clint Eastwood to me, that. Well,
a good few minutes of him later on.
Oh, good, good, good. Now, we don't often hear on Space Boffins feature the many Earth observation satellites that watch and monitor our planet. But a new one due for launch on a SpaceX from California in May has grabbed our attention. The European Space Agency's Earth Cloud Aerosol and Radiation Explorer, or EarthCare, satellite mission is all about understanding climate change.
Yeah, it's fitted with a space laser.
Woo!
EarthCare, it's taken decades to develop and will shed new light on the role that clouds and aerosols, their small particles in the atmosphere, play in regulating Earth's climate. The mission has significant UK involvement, which much of the spacecraft built just down the road from Space Boffins HQ at Airbus in Stevenage. Now, I've been chatting to Robin Hogan, who's a principal scientist at the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts. He's co-chair of the EarthCare Mission Advisory Group.
Clouds are obviously something that affects the weather that we experience every day, and they block the sunlight. So we're very familiar with, you know, how important a cloud forecast is. They're very important also for climate. So we're in a climate emergency, let's be honest. We really need to reduce to zero the amount of fossil fuels that we're burning. That's very clear. One of the key scientific questions we have is how can we predict how much climate will change given a certain amount of carbon dioxide that we emit. Now, that we can do, and we're very confident that we're going to warm the climate, but one of the key difficulties we have is exactly how much depends on what clouds do. And the fundamental thing is that if you warm the climate, then the clouds are going to respond. So they might get more of them or less of them, and they might change their properties. So if clouds reduce in their cloud cover, then this would mean that they reflect less sunlight, and that would mean more energy comes from the sun and gets absorbed by the surface. So that would act as an amplifier of climate change. Unfortunately, that means that we need to represent them really quite accurately in our numerical models that we use to make climate projections. And this is quite an uncertain process. Clouds have processes that occur on very small scales, and we can only represent the atmosphere in sort of boxes that are, you know, larger than 10 kilometers typically in a computer simulation. So we want to measure much more accurately than we've ever been able to do before the properties of clouds and aerosol particles. And that's really where this EarthCare satellite is going to be a revolution.
So just coming back to that, this is all about heat coming into the Earth from the sun and heat reflected back off the Earth into space and the effect the clouds and the aerosols have on that.
Yes, so there's two main types of, we would call atmospheric radiation. Of course, there's the sunlight we're very familiar with. Clouds primarily reflect the sunlight back to space, so they have a cooling effect on climate. But they also have an effect that's very similar to a greenhouse effect, which is in the infrared part of the spectrum, so the thermal emission. If you put clouds in the atmosphere, then they emit radiation in the infrared up and down. The amount they emit down to the ground actually warms us at the surface. So you will have experienced the sort of weather forecast. It's very important to get the clouds right at night because it's much warmer in the morning if there were clouds there than if there weren't. So there's these two ways that we need to get right to get the full effect of clouds on weather and climate.
And is climate affecting the amount of cloud we're getting as well as the Earth warms? We talk about a lot of wet weather. particularly in the UK. I mean, it's been horrendous this year.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
You know, particularly February, I think the wettest February on record, for example. So is there an effect there where we're, as the climate changes, we're actually ending up with more cloud?
It really depends what sorts of clouds you're looking at. And this is a big scientific question. I mean, it's super interesting. The types of clouds we might be dealing with, clouds over land, we think they're probably going to decrease. Land is actually warming faster than the global average. So when you hear that we've raised the temperatures since pre-industrial times by 1.2 degrees, something like that, it's actually more than that over land. And that means that land typically in our latitudes is getting a bit, the air is getting a bit drier. So there's probably fewer clouds. This is quite uncertain. One of the fairly robust predictions of weather, climate simulations is that dry areas get drier and wet areas get wetter. So when we get very strong wet weather, it tends to be wetter than it would have been without the impact of climate change. But then droughts are likely to get stronger as well. So these kind of changes in weather patterns are really how we're going to experience climate change. It's going to be through the extremes in particular. And the predictions for, you know, extremes, more heavy rain events, but also more droughts, means that, you know, it's crucial we're able to improve our prediction capabilities in order that we can adapt to climate change, as well as really reinforcing the need to mitigate it and to reduce our carbon footprint, our fossil fuel usage.
Let's talk then about the spacecraft itself. I loved there was when it was first commissioned, the BBC headline on the website was "Space Laser." You can't go wrong with a space laser. There's nothing sinister about this, but it is quite interesting technology and something that's not really been tried at this precision before.
That's right. I mean, EarthCare is novel for a number of reasons, but I mean, the key thing is it's got actually four instruments on board. Well, we call it a LIDAR, so that's using a laser, but in the same way as a radar, and that you send out a pulse. In this case, it's a pulse of ultraviolet light down to the surface, and then from the time it takes to get back and the strength of that echo, you can work out the properties of clouds and aerosols. So that's the LIDAR, which sends out this pulse of ultraviolet light. But there's also a radar. So this is going to be the first cloud radar in space that can actually not only measure how far away the clouds are and how strong the return is, which tells you about the clouds and the precipitation. It can also measure the fall speeds of particles in the atmosphere. This is something we've never been able to do before on a global scale. And then it's got a couple more instruments that will enable us to determine the properties of the clouds as they interact with sunlight and infrared radiation. So we're really able to answer the overall climate question: how important are those clouds and aerosol particles for climate? So it's really this synergy, we would say, of all the instruments that really adds the power to the EarthCare satellite.
So obviously you're looking at long-term measurements and a big picture here and feeding into climate models and how the Earth's going to change. But you're getting presumably useful short-term data here as well. You're talking about, you know, the speeds, for example.
Yes, absolutely. So there's a number of different ways that we're going to be able to use the EarthCare data. One of them, as you say, is to improve our understanding of the processes going on in clouds and their properties. But also one of the exciting things for my own work, so I work, as I said, in the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts. We do weather forecasts routinely across the whole globe, and we have, you know, tens of thousands of users around the world. And we're actually not only going to be able to improve our weather forecast models, we're going to be able to assimilate the observations. So that means that they're going to come in near real time, and we're going to use them to improve the initial conditions. So that's the starting conditions, particularly the locations of the clouds that we'll have, which means that our forecasts will be more accurate because they're going to start from a better understanding of what the present state of the atmosphere is. So yes, indeed, the timescale at which EarthCare data are going to be used is very, very wide.
How difficult has it been to develop? Because I mentioned that BBC article. That was actually from, I think, 2011. So, I mean, I'm guessing this hasn't been easy. This is not something you can just shove together and stick up in space.
Well, absolutely, yes. So there's a huge amount of engineering novelty and clever ideas that have been put into practice in this mission. And putting four instruments on the same platform also is a challenge, because during the development, there's always one that's got some problem that you have to solve. In the case of the laser, I mean, that's really quite amazing technology. I should say the European Space Agency, which is developing the satellites jointly with the Japanese Space Agency, has actually launched a slightly different type of laser, but the same fundamental idea, which is the way it observes the frequency of the radiation, the wavelength of the radiation that might be changed as it comes back to the instrument. That's actually went up in the AEOLAS satellite that was launched in 2018. That was to measure winds, but the same kind of technology is being used for EarthCare, but much more to measure clouds and aerosol particles. So we're able to leverage the know-how that ESA gained from developing that instrument in EarthCare. And so we're building on a sequence of technological developments.
And where are you at? I mean, is it ready for launch? Are you excited about launch? I always ask this question. I mean, everyone's always as excited but terrified. How do you feel?
The satellite is currently in the Vandenberg Space Base, which is in California. It's ready to be launched in May 2024, so really quite soon. It's, I mean, as far as we can tell, everything is all ready to go. It's going up on a Falcon 9 SpaceX rocket. It will be terrifying. I mean, you're seeing 25 years of work strapped to a rocket. I mean, they've got a very good record of launching satellites safely. I understand that they launch maybe three satellites a week. So for them, this is quite a routine thing. But for us, you know, this is like a lifetime's work, you know, really, really in one moment that you kind of hope everything goes well.
Robin Hogan, one of the scientists working on EarthCare, which is due for launch very shortly. Now, after our conversation, Robin did send me an email with an extensive list of all the UK involvement in the mission, which is, I should say, funded through the UK Space Agency. I won't go through it all, but I should just mention SSTL. They built the imager on the satellites, and SEA, I'm not sure whether they're C or SEA, who led the development of another of the instruments.
Well, as Robin mentioned, EarthCare is due for launch in the next month. And the other big news is that Boeing's Starliner is finally counting down to its first crewed mission. Now, it's been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Yeah, I made a prediction. I got it very wrong. In 2019, I predicted, everyone was talking about Up Dragon.
Yeah.
And I predicted, maybe the contrarian in me, that Starliner would be first and we should all get excited about Starliner. Well, I was wrong. You may remember its first uncrewed test flight in 2019 had all sorts of software issues. It failed to dock with the International Space Station. And then since then, a series of hardware issues until finally a successful test flight last year. But you look at it, it's a pretty cool spacecraft. It's interesting, very different to the Dragon. This I found staggering, actually. It can carry up to 7 crew.
Wow.
So it'll be 4 usually for NASA to the International Space Station. And a bit like Dragon, Boeing says it's fully autonomous, and they liken it on their website to a self-driving car. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure that's a good analogy considering what's being in the news every now and then.
It's due for launch early May. The astronauts, I love this guy, Barry Butch Wilmore.
Butch,
really.
Oh, no.
And the lovely Sunita Williams. They're on a week-long mission to the ISS in blue spacesuits. I have met Sunita Williams. I've not interviewed her.
Yeah.
I actually met her at a party. Had a lovely chat with her at a party.
Yeah, I remember you coming back and saying how nice she is.
She was.
I had a look at those blue spacesuits. I must admit, my first thought was really shallow, was like wrong blue.
I thought they looked like...
Even though it's Everton blue, it's quite royal blue. I just thought, no. But actually, I like the little bit of the groovy sort of star at the side running down the arm with the long ray coming from it. Or maybe it's the sun or something, but... That was quite cool. And I like the boots, the built-in boots, which I was pleased to see that they've got 10 different sizes and 4 different sizes space suits.
I thought it was, I mean, as pressure suits go, it's an awful lot better than the Russian one.
Well, they say it's got more flexibility, which is why they've got those sort of almost like, sort of 16th century ruches around their shoulders.
And
like
obviously, you know, that you can imagine the meeting, they went out of their way to distinguish them from the black and white of SpaceX. So, yeah, well
okay.
Let's see. What I think is incredible about this, when you think about it, the US will have 3 human-rated spacecraft. So they'll have Starliner, assuming this works, Starliner, Dragon, and Orion.
So after... Space Shuttle, we wait and wait for nothing, and then light buses three come along at once.
There you go. But I mean, that's quite the turnaround, isn't it? This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientists.
Do get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks as ever for your kind comments. And you can also email us, podcast@spaceboffins.com.
Next, we head 173 million kilometres from Earth and counting to Bepi Colombo, Europe's mission to study Mercury. And rather than going direct, it's fair to say Bepi Colombo is taking the long way round the solar system, the pretty route.
The scenic route. Yeah.
Launched in 2018, it's due to arrive at the planet next year.
Well, at the recent Space Expo at Farnborough, I caught up with one of the scientists on the mission, and that's Susie Imber. As well as being a professor of planetary science at the University of Leicester, you might remember her here in the UK as the winner of the BBC's reality show Astronauts. She's also a keen high altitude mountaineer. She's an elite rower. She's part of a mountain rescue team that helps with people who've got into trouble in inaccessible parts of the Peak District. All in all, Susie is a pretty impressive individual. And we began by talking about Bepi Colombo's journey.
The way that it approaches Mercury is doing many laps of the solar system, and it passes by planets as it does so, and it uses the gravitational field of the planets to slow it down and to change its trajectory. So we've had some flybys of the Earth and Venus, and now we're starting to have some flybys of Mercury. So we're approaching Mercury. It's going to take another 18 months and another few flybys before we finally end up getting captured by Mercury's weak gravitational field, and we finally have the last few phases where we separate the spacecraft and start taking science data, but we're in the final phases now.
Well, it's great to be able to actually get to a point where we can now say it will arrive at Mercury next year, effectively, or in orbit.
Yeah, we're pretty excited by that, actually. December 2025 is a big date for us that we've been looking forward to for just over seven years. So, yeah, it feels like we're at the final phases now.
Leicester University is responsible for one specific instrument. Remind us of what this instrument will do and whether it's been quiet or not on the way there.
So we're responsible for the Mercury Imaging X-ray Spectrometer, or MIX. Everything has an acronym in space physics. And MIX is an instrument that is an X-ray detector. And so the idea behind the instrument is that the sun gives off X-rays all the time. They get absorbed by the surface layer of atoms, so on the sunlit side of the planet. We get an X-ray re-emitted that we then detect. And the X-ray, the property of the X-ray that we measure, tells us the atom that gave off that X-ray. And so we build up a picture of the composition of the surface of the planet. So that's the idea behind the instrument originally. We have some more ideas of how we can deploy this instrument now, because since launch, we discovered that the auroral signatures on Mercury appear in X-rays. So unlike on the Earth, where they're invisible light, on Mercury we see X-rays coming off the dark side of the planet, and we think that they're auroral X-rays. We didn't know about these when the instrument was being designed, and now we think we're going to be able to use the instrument to analyse those X-rays and tell us about the magnetospheric physics of Mercury as well as the composition. So now we have a couple of goals to go for with our instrument.
So that's quite exciting. You've effectively got a new unexpected experiment that, as you say, you hadn't planned, but it's now going to look at. Do we have auroral X-rays on Earth as well?
The aurora that we see in the Earth is invisible.
It's not a combination of the two, then?
No, because at the Earth, the incoming particles hit the atmosphere and they make the atmosphere glow, visible in UV light. At Mercury, there's no atmosphere to hit, so these particles actually hit the surface and make the surface glow, and they glow in X-rays. So it's the same physical process that drives the emission, but it's in a different wavelength. And in answer to your question about our instrument, on the journey, some of the instruments have been switched on and taking observations, particularly interesting places like past some of the planets, etc. Our instrument is sitting in a place in the spacecraft where it's pointing straight at another piece of the spacecraft. And so it can't see anything until the whole mission splits apart and its field of view is opened up, and then it can start taking data. So we have a calibration source on board. We're able to check that our instrument is in good health, but it can't make any of the measurements that we want to make until it arrives.
So as someone who specialises in space weather, this X-ray aurora is effectively right up your street. What other research have you been doing while Bepi Colombo has been on its way to Mercury?
So I have a research program that looks not just at Mercury, but also at the Earth. And so we've been looking with a suite of instruments at the Earth at the effects of space weather on ground magnetic field measurements. So we'd like to know about currents that are induced in the Earth and in any metallic objects, long metallic objects on the Earth's surface, like power lines, that kind of thing. And we do that using grids of ground-based magnetometers, so ground-based magnetic field measurements. And these are caused by huge currents that flow above us that cause these inductive currents. So we've been looking at those, trying to understand. We sometimes see these spikes in currents on the Earth's surface, and we'd like to know what causes those spikes to happen, because they're very intense and they could be quite damaging.
Is this relating to the one that was in the 1980s that was experienced in Canada when there was a surge and it took out power plants?
Yeah, that happened in Quebec in 1989, I think. Obviously, that was a long time ago. We do see smaller events on a more regular basis and larger events more rarely. We know this event in Quebec was by no means the largest that could happen. The largest that we know of happened in the 1850s. So you see, we see the scale where there are very few big events and lots of small ones, and we're trying to use the small ones to understand what a big one might do, what the impact could be, and how we can sort of protect ourselves against these big events. And Mercury fits into that quite nicely, because Mercury experiences these largest events we could ever happen on the Earth, that happen once a century here, maybe. Mercury sees them every day, and that's why the dynamics of Mercury is interesting to me, because the physics is the same, and so we're trying to understand the physics of Mercury and apply that knowledge to the Earth.
You mentioned in the 1800s that one is known as the Carrington event, and obviously at that time there probably were very few electrical devices that, you know, could have been affected. But were there any instances where the effect was recorded?
Yes, telegram operators got electric shocks in their ears because they had long cables that had currents induced in them. I think the aurora was seen as far south as Rome, actually. So we know it was a really extreme event from observations of the aurora and some observations of these telegram operators. But other than that, we don't have that many clues. Anything that drives the aurora that far south gives us some really big hints about the dynamics that must have forced that auroral signature to go as far south as it did. And so just those observations tell us the scale of the event that happened.
I've been lucky. I've seen aurora several times in Finland and in Alaska. And I have an app, you know, Aurora Watch.
Yes.
Aurora Watch for the UK.
Yeah.
And it's been astonishing the last few months. It's going off non-stop, and it's not only saying, you know, red as in it's visible, it's very strong likelihood, it's saying it's visible across the whole of the UK. Is this because we're reaching a solar maximum?
What we find is that solar activity and auroral activity are strongly linked. So the sun has an 11-year cycle. Solar maximum causes different properties in the solar wind that can drive more frequent and more intense auroral activity. The declining phase of the solar cycle, when we're just past maximum, we see lots of coronal holes that drives a fast solar wind, and that again drives really dynamic auroras. So we expect to see more frequent and intense events over the next few years. What I'm really cautious about doing is saying that means there's going to be some massive event, because these huge events, they happen so rarely, we can't link them necessarily.
The Earth
to
basically
parts.
Has to be in the firing line, doesn't it?
Well, the Earth has to be in the firing line, for sure. But also, this scale of events, these, you know, we've only ever seen one Carrington event. I can't possibly link it to any phase of the solar cycle. All I can say is that during solar maximum and declining phase, we expect to see more frequent and intense events coming from the sun that drives more frequent and intense aurora for us on Earth. I think a one-off freak Carrington event, you know, you can't predict that that's going to happen. It's really outside of our realm at the moment. But we'd like to be able to predict these things, or at least to be able to track them and have some warning that they're heading our way. And we're making great strides in that direction, in order that we can maybe do something about some of the technology that might be damaged.
Yeah, fingers crossed that's not going to happen. So when Bepi Colombo arrives at Mercury, will you then sort of switch your research, your current research, back into sort of Bepi Colombo mode?
I plan on doing both, actually. I want to continue my work on the Earth, but I'll certainly spend a large amount of my time switching towards BepiColombo because it's probably going to have a 2 Earth year lifetime, so its lifetime is short, and we want to be able to publish the results as quickly as we can from all of the exciting work that's going on. Having said that, even a short mission has a long time frame of research that follows it, and so we can expect to be analysing this data for probably 10 years from now. I'll still be looking at BepiColombo data because there'll be so much of it and it's so high quality. So I'd like to continue both research streams because they're so linked. It makes sense to do both, I think.
Professor Susie Imber from the University of Leicester, and no doubt we will hopefully, fingers crossed, be doing some more about BepiColombo next year.
Should we talk about the eclipse?
Oh, yes, please.
I have a clip. Would you like to hear it?
Should we say where we are first?
Northwestern Pennsylvania.
Yeah, near the Ohio border. In fact, in a state park that crossed both states. The forecast had been, let's be fair, pretty dreadful. And when we got up in the morning, I took a picture of the sky. In fact, I don't think you could see any blue
raining.
In the sky for at least 4 hours.
It was raining
it was
raining at 7 in the morning.
And then the magic happened.
Fantastic. So you're a journalist of how many years? And how did you articulate the eclipse?
Ah, fabulous. As you can tell, I was very excited. I mean, you should have heard me when I was talking about when I spotted the prominences, because I've seen about 4 or 5 eclipses now. And that's the first time I have seen such huge, huge prominences. I mean, bright, sort of orangey right at the bottom. And oh my goodness, that was so exciting. And that's because we are in this period of solar maximum. And, you know, some people who've got, I mean, we didn't, you know, have fancy cameras or anything.
Well, no one did. That's what was so amazing about that.
Yeah.
I think where we were, because we're in this state park, it was mostly families. It was a very sweary fisherman near us.
Oh, yeah.
There were families. We were with a bunch of students.
With our son and grad students from Penn State University. Hello, Penn State University.
We are.
Yes.
And, you know, so it was just a bunch of ordinary people. So I didn't see any telescopes or any gear. People had the little glasses.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were looking up at it with the glasses as the sun was kind of getting eaten away by the moon.
Yeah.
But, you know, you kind of look up every few minutes and another bit gets eaten.
I was
just
looking
at it
constantly.
And munched
like
you were. But most people were just sort of looking up. But you can't articulate to people, you can't explain to people what it's going to be like.
Yeah, the difference between a partial and a full solar is massive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then everyone just across the park went, wow.
Yeah.
That was just incredible.
No, it was. It was. I think what made it better for us or more exciting, as you could tell, I was very excited, was that we had low expectations. You're the pessimist, I'm the optimist. So I'm still like, yeah, we might have a 50% chance. It could be fine, you know, even despite the sky. And so we just went for a walk, didn't we? And then it just got
better and
it
better.
It got better. And then we saw a bit of blue and then a bit more. And then the grad students were all playing frisbee and making tin foil hats. No doubt for the aliens, got some odd looks, but they were very funny. And then when it came to it, a small bit of cloud came over and it was like, no, come on, not for the totality. Come on, no. And it just disappeared
stayed
and we saw the
whole
lot.
I have to say, I really feel, because people plan these things years in advance, because we're already looking at Egypt and that's like
Yeah, that's
two,
2026.
Two off.
It's, yeah.
Yeah,
it goes
across. I thought that was the 27?
No, I think it's 2026.
Oh, it's the 25 one that's Reykjavik, isn't it?
Yeah. 2026 goes across northern Spain. I think it goes across the whole of Mallorca. And then I didn't find out until a friend of ours who's a big space fan, and she said, it's over Egypt. And we went to Egypt with Gabrielle and her partner Lawrence last year, had an amazing time. So that's an opportunity Luxor.
We're planning for that. And loads of people planned for this one.
Yeah.
And they went, you know, particularly to Texas.
Because that was our original plan.
I can't help feeling bad for them, because we chose where we were going to go in that morning.
Yes.
We got out of the hotel. Well,
obviously, we went to Pennsylvania because our son was there. Yeah. But, and yeah, you're right.
We just chose the location that morning based on a conversation we had with someone in the hotel at breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah. And just went in and just looked for parks.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing. Because the last one we saw, the 2017 one in, we saw that from Oregon. That was fabulous. And that was in this lovely place.
Oregon State University.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to remember the name of the... Cornwallis.
Yeah.
Beautiful, yeah. Beautiful little town.
Yeah.
And that was lovely, wasn't it, to be in a sort of school field or some sort of playing field.
Again, it was a shared experience.
Because it was a shared experience with lots of people. But this, because we were right by a lake and trees and a bit more rural, had another. And that's the nice thing, isn't it? Depending on where you go, you get the added landscape to it. Because the Peru one I saw years ago, that was in the Atacama Desert. And so that looked like a Martian or a moon surface. So that looked otherworldly. And as you know, we were on the beach in Cornwall in 1999 where it's the grey sky didn't actually improve from a grey sky, she says bitterly.
Miserable day.
But get planning if you're in Europe. And you know it's going to be in northern Spain, which is reasonably inexpensive. But plan it now because hotels are already booking up, like in Egypt. Apparently they're booking up already. So, but it'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. Try and do it. And even if you can go somewhere close, maybe southern France, and then maybe drive over a day before or in the morning or whatever, do that. You will not regret it.
Last month, I mentioned George Abbey, fair to say, a NASA legend who died in March. A former pilot in the US Air Force, George worked for the deputy director of the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, George Lowe, and later was responsible for space shuttle crew selection. George Abbey's name frequently comes up in astronaut autobiographies, although I have to say not always in a positive way, particularly in Mike Mullane's book, Riding Rockets.
Mike's book, it's a touchstone, isn't it?
Still the best. Now, I met George back in 2018 when I was making a radio documentary on the Apollo missions, 7, 8, 9 and 10, leading up to the Apollo 11 moon landing. I should add that George speaks in quite a slow, deliberate... gravelly manner. So I thought we'd just play a couple of extracts from that conversation. The first is when I asked him about Apollo 7, commanded by Wally Shearer alongside Walt Cunningham and Don Eisel in 1968.
Well, Apollo 7 was the first manned mission, and we had the tragedy of Apollo 1. I was working in the program at that time for the program manager, and then subsequently went to work for George Lowe, who became the new program manager, and we had a commitment to land astronauts safely on the moon and return to Earth by the end of the decade. And with the Apollo 1 tragedy, that had put us really in a difficult situation as achieving that goal. And we really had to, because of the fire, had to come up with a lot of new non-flammable materials. Didn't burn in oxygen. We had to test them and then fabricate new materials for the cabin out of that material and then redesign the hatch to make it a quick opening hatch, because the hatch we had at the time of Apollo 1 was an inward opening hatch, and that was a factor in the crew not being able to escape. And we also improved the other systems on board the Apollo spacecraft. So we had all that to do, and Apollo 7 was going to be the first manned flight that incorporated all those changes. And it was really the key to the success of our subsequent missions. So when you fly a new spacecraft for the first time, it's always a challenge, because you encounter problems that you couldn't foresee. And being able to do it and do it flawlessly is really a difficult thing to achieve. And that was what we were faced with Apollo 7. The other problem that arose with Apollo 7 was that the individual I worked for, George Lowe, was a program manager, and he had taken he didn't take vacations, but that summer in 1968 he took a week off, and because he was working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And he came back from the vacation and told me that he'd come up with a new plan, because he said if we maintained the present sequence of missions, we probably weren't going to land by the end of the decade. And he had a new approach and was going to propose to the NASA leadership that if Apollo 7 was successful, that we would go to the moon on the next flight, Apollo 8, with a command and service module. And that would allow us to really make a major step forward and learn how to get to the moon and fly the trajectories to the moon and fly in orbit around the moon and really do all that before we had a lunar module. And it would be a major step forward.
What was the reaction to that idea?
Well, it was he got very readily acceptance by Bob Gilruth and Dick Slayton and Chris Kraft and Max Faget, who were the leadership here at the center, and General Sam Phillips, who was the program director in Washington. And then they flew over to Huntsville, Alabama, and met to meet with General Phillips and Wernher von Braun and Kurt Divas from the Marshall Space Flight Center and Kennedy Space Flight Center, and they all agreed this was a good plan. Then they had to convince George Miller, who was the Associate Administrator for Spaceflight, and he was out of the country, and they called him, and he was not. He was very reluctant to agree to it, and it took a good bit of effort to get his agreement. And then they still had to get agreement from the Administrator of NASA, Jim Webb, and that was even more of a challenge because he was very uneasy about taking that biggest step. And they finally got him to agree that if Apollo 7 was successful and achieved all the objectives, that we would then go ahead and take Apollo 8 to the moon 2 months later.
I mean, it was an audacious decision, wasn't it? It was also a risky decision to fly to the moon, and as we saw with Apollo 13, you've got no lifeboats, you've got nothing before, we've just got one command module on a rocket that has had problems up to that point.
And that's very true. That's why you wanted to be sure that you had a spacecraft that you had high confidence in, and that made the Apollo 7 mission even more critical. The other thing that was a factor in that was the Apollo 8 mission going to the moon would require a Saturn V. And the Saturn V had only flown 2 unmanned flights. The first flight had been acceptable, but the second flight had been a major problem. When the second stage engines had shut down in flight, the third engine, which was needed to restart to take you on a trajectory to the moon, wouldn't restart. And the spacecraft LEM adapter structure that surrounded where the lunar module was came apart in flight. So at the same time we were getting ready to fly Apollo 7, we had to determine what caused all those problems. We had to fix those problems and test them. If we were going to have a Saturn V that we would put humans on for the first time in December with Apollo 8. So all that was being done in parallel, and the first flight after that disastrous flight in April of 1968, the next flight in December, we put humans on a Saturn V. And that, As you point out, relative to the spacecraft, the launch vehicle has got to be acceptable as well, and you have to have confidence it's going to work. So if you look at Apollo 8 and the complexity of it and what had to be done to make sure it was successful, Apollo 7 had to be a real success, and Saturn V had to prove itself in all its testing leading up to putting humans on it for the first time in December.
You look at the way that even at the time Apollo 7 was reported, you look at the transcripts, but also the way it was reported at the time, that there's this sort of back chat between the astronauts and mission control, and this breaking down. I interviewed Jerry Griffin about this, this sort of breaking down of the normal relationship. What's your take on that?
Well, that did occur, but that was independent of how well the spacecraft worked. So that was more of personalities and relationships, and those things are certainly important, and you want them to be all working as a team. But having the spacecraft and confidence in the spacecraft and its systems really was more important.
Is that the reason that that crew never flew again? I mean, Wally Schirra was probably going to leave NASA anyway, but what about the other two?
Well, I think that probably was a factor in their not flying again. There's a program that was done about Deke Slayton, and there's an interviewer that asked Chris Kraft if that was a reason, you know, that he said that. Did he ever say that Wally Schirra would never fly again? He, in that interview, it's on video, you can watch it, and he said, "I'm glad you asked that question. I'd like to clarify that because I never did say that. I didn't say that at all. I said he would fly over my dead body."
George Abbey. By the way, that documentary is still on the BBC Sounds site. BBC Sounds. I don't think you have to say site. It's BBC Sounds. It's called 10987. So if you Google 10987 BBC, you will find it. It's very good. It has some great music in when we were allowed to put commercial music in podcasts.
It's not anymore.
Don't tell anyone, though. I did just want to play one other section of the interview with George. And after he'd finished answering my questions, he was very keen to start the recorder again and make a point about all the Brits who worked on the Apollo program. It's a story that's rarely been told.
Well, I think we're very fortunate that we got some very experienced British engineers involved in the program. They had come over after World War II to work in Avro, Canada, and Avro, Canada was one of the most outstanding aircraft companies in the world and produced a fighter that was way ahead of its time, and it really hadn't been equaled, the Avro Arrow. And those individuals were intimately involved in that design, and that's why that aircraft was successful. And then when the Prime Minister of Canada decided overnight to cancel it, they were laid off. And at that same time, of course, we had been starting the Mercury program, and Bob Gilruth was director of the Mercury program, and he had worked with the Avro engineers at Langley Field in Virginia because we had the wind tunnels there. And so the Avro people would come down and use the wind tunnels that were at that time run by the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which was a predecessor of NASA. And he got to know a number of those engineers. So when he found out they'd been laid off and were available, he got in one of the NASA airplanes and headed to Toronto and got a number of the engineers together in a cafeteria and interviewed them and selected some of the top engineers from Avro and hired them in NASA, and they became NASA engineers. They came down to the United States and made major contributions to the program, and they were put in major roles of responsibility in Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. The whole network around the world, communication network around the world, was laid out and run by Techwin Roberts, an Avro engineer, and who had been educated in the UK. And if you look at all their backgrounds, they were all educated in the UK and made major contributions to our program. So if you look at the UK's involvement, they played a major role in what we did in those early years, and I would hope that those individuals would get the recognition they deserve in the United Kingdom.
Do you think they've been forgotten or assumed that they were Americans rather than they had a background in Britain? I mean, obviously, they became American.
No, they all retained their accents, and they all had close ties in the UK and family in the UK, so they maintained that relationship even though they were here in Texas. And there are, unfortunately, only a few of them left alive, but they really should get the recognition they really deserve.
the gravelly voice of George Abbey, who died in March. It's a fascinating story, that Brits of Apollo, one we are hoping to one day turn into a film. So if you happen to have around 100 grand, I reckon.
yeah, we can do it. And actually, at least we have, over the last 13 years on Space Boffins, we have featured some of the older British people who were involved in the space program here, as well as being fortunate enough, I met some of them over in Florida as well, who'd gone over and worked there. And it is interesting. It's so, if your relative is still alive and Compass Mentis, you know, let us know, or if you've got recordings yourself of things that they've done, because we'd really love to hear it and maybe use them for a documentary, because it's important to have all this history.
It's a really important story. They were really significant, as George Abbey said. And yes, he particularly wanted to make that point. Mm. Well, next time we will hopefully be celebrating the first flight of Starliner.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Do get in touch, write a review on your podcast platform of choice, and tell more people about us.
We are kindly supported by the UK Space Agency. We'll be back next month. Thanks for listening.